So we are in Room Kydonia. It's the 20th of August, and it's, what time is it? 9:20, and we are having a session about DevOps tools.
Yeah, so I could show a few things or talk about the Netflix tools if you are interested in that. So the best way to go is start kind of show off netflix.github.com.io. This is their repository of all the open source projects that they've put out in the last year and a half. So there's quite a few, 30-ish right now. 34 public repos. Some of them are just little tiny things, but there's quite a few. And these are kind of categorized into tools or libraries. And the libraries are almost, they're all JVM, not all, but mostly JVM-based libraries. There's a few things that are Python-based. Some of the teams use Python. Well, there's Hadoop platform as a service. Governator is a library for Zookeeper. Oh, no, this one, sorry. For object lifetime to go with use. Same guy also did Curator, that's the Zookeeper. But so the tools that are sort of DevOps related are the ones that sound like Norse mythology. So, because that's the tools team, likes the Norse pantheon. So Asgard is the tool which is sort of their DevOps admin tool. It's a Grails app, talks to AWS APIs directly. And kind of can visualize what's going on in your account, your AWS account, and help you manage things. And it lets you work with auto-scaling groups pretty nicely. And Blueberry's the Amazon console doesn't even show them at all. And so that's sort of the unit of deployment that Netflix uses for managing all of their servers. So they use the auto-scaling service from Amazon, which is free to use on its own. They don't charge you for behavior of the service or API calls to the service. I mean, it will start machines and then you take the machines, but it's a free thing that you can use. And even in the cases before Netflix actually auto-scaled, they used the auto-scaling groups because it allows you to do a couple things. One of them is it ensures that the entire cluster group of machines are all launched from the same image. So they're all identical. You don't have snowflakes of, well, somebody started these later and used a different chef setup. This is different and that's different. They're always going to be identical. And it also groups them in a way that they can easily be organized and discovered. So then you can say, oh, these 30 machines belong to this cluster of, you know, cache or something. And you know, this team owns that cluster as part of their app. And so you can help organize your whole cloud space, which is can be a bit of a problem when everybody in the company or many teams have access to AWS and they're all creating machines and things and nobody knows who owns what. Can this be deleted or not? People tend to then not delete anything because they don't know who it belongs to. You know, this garbage will build up and somebody's paying the bill for it.
But it's only for use with Amazon or?
Yeah, so right now Asgard works with AWS APIs directly, so it works with Amazon, but Eucalyptus is AWS compatible, and Eucalyptus guys are porting all of their stuff, and they deliver, I think they deliver a bundle you can get from them. That's a version of Asgard that's just been tweaked a little bit. And there isn't that much they have to do, and they'll probably push back to this pull request, I think, ready to go in pretty soon. It's like, so one thing Asgard will show you, for example, and I can flip over. So that's what it looks like. It can show you like what instance types you have. So this will tell you, okay, here's all the different kinds of machines are available. So it's an API call to Amazon. So what are the types? And it enumerates them all and finds out all about them. And I think it's not a proper API call. You need to do some scraping to find it from Amazon. So in Eucalyptus version, it's not the same implementation. It's basically whoever installed Eucalyptus at your company set up whatever types you wanted, and you can describe that any way you want, and a price could be anything you want. If you care, you even have like a budgeting amount that you put in to manage the prices of your own machines, just so people know how much they're worth. So this is an example for like Eucalyptus cases. It's done differently. but it organizes them to the front page, which shows you kind of basic stats and what it's talking to, the endpoints. Applications, so yeah, this, so I'm running that local instance here, it's not connected to anything. Asgard has one sort of high level notation on top of the standard Amazon thing. So it just says, well, let's have a notion of an app. It registers it, apps in SimpleDB. It's just one table record per app. It's just the name of the app and the email and the owner of the team. Which team does this app belong to, and kind of what kind it is and when it was made, and a description. And there isn't much to it.
If it's also straight from AWS, or is it just your local registry?
So the implementation that comes with Asgard uses SimpleDB.
Okay.
So not from AWS, but you can plug that in with something else. It could be.
But it doesn't scrape it off from Amazon.
No.
It's a local repository.
It's
an Asgard repository.
Yeah, yeah. It's an Asgard SimpleDB that creates on demand, but you could change it. It could even be a flat file somewhere. Or an S3 file in S3, you know, in CSV or something like that. It's really, there's not much to it. But this allows it to know, sort of using naming conventions and other metadata, who belongs to what. So when we create an application, I can just say, okay, it's my app. This is not very well enforced, exactly what this is supposed to be. Records whatever you have, so I can't get to it at this point. Okay. I don't have the keys configured. They also have very cute error message pages. So once you have an app, then you can take a look at like, what are all the machine images that you have. Normally have a whole huge list of all the machines that would be machine images, right? So these are, you know, it's like a VM image, I don't know if you've worked with VMware or any of those, or even like VirtualBox, that kind of thing, right? So Amazon has a machine image notion, and they're just a bunch of, it's disk image registered with some metadata that's sitting on S3 somewhere. So you can identify, I want to launch the machine. So there's a bunch that are public that you can get from Red Hat, CentOS, Fedora, Ubuntu, Windows, if you want to launch Windows. And they'd be all listed here. So this is just you browse through them.
The app's not tied to a machine image necessarily, right?
Sorry?
The app, where you have the app list, is that necessarily tied to a machine image? Or
no,
they're
orthogonal. Yeah. So what you would normally do, so if you're just booting, the machine image list is going to be anything, right? This will show you every possible thing. But normally, in the Netflix model, and this was what I wanted to talk about in the next topic, is you would create your machine image as part of your build process. So your app would actually be baked into a machine image. So you'd say, okay, I'm going to run my Java app, it's going to run a Tomcat, I've got Apache in front of it, I've got the monitoring daemons that run on the machine. Basically, just do a build of the whole machine and put that on, I want it on Ubuntu, 12.4, and then snapshot that whole machine.
So class object type, same idea.
Yeah.
The app list is just defines the apps that are available and the instances will run on a specific machine.
Yeah. I think that's right. So the Netflix open source back to here, this one called Aminator is the tool for creating the AMIs that Netflix has made. There's another one that another guy has done, it's called Packer, which is interesting, and he is basically, they're kind of competitive in some ways, but they're taking a different approach, so it's very interesting to see. But I think they want to cross-pollinate some of the ideas. Packer doesn't need stuff, it's command line, it's more powerful for other kinds of image creation. It can create AMIs, it can also create VMware images, it can create VirtualBox, Vagrant images. So you can use Packer on your desktop to make Vagrant images and test stuff. So it's pretty cool. It's sort of a, But, so the idea is once you have an image, then it has your app on it. It would have a complete ready to run instance of your app with all the things it needs to get going. So the Tomcat, Java, whatever version of Java, command lines, boot up arguments, everything, right? So when that machine starts, your app just runs. And it would be a particular version of your app. If you rebuilt your app, you completely rebuild the whole new image just from scratch. It's just, so you're building kind of the first principles from source code, you're reproducing an image all the way to complete sort of reproducible pipeline. And that way then you go to the cluster page or the autoscaling group page.
And are you always building the whole image and then deploy the whole image to
yes.
Yeah. Isn't there a kind of update tool or something that you just update the application?
No. Well, you could, but you don't want to.
Okay.
It'd be just like, so think of, this is sort of a change in mentality with the cloud. Think of the cloud machines as just disposable, right? When you're done, you want to update the machine, you don't try to update the machine, you throw it away. You make a new one first, you make sure it's good, then you throw it over.
It's like a really snapshot thing.
Yeah, but even in production machines, you've got a cluster of 100, you're running your old production version, and you want the new one, you make the new 100, make sure it's good, send the traffic to the new one, and you just kill the old one. Or you keep it as long as you need to make sure the new one's going to be stable. But everything is disposable. So even if you wanted like a patch to the new one, you just throw the old away and put the patch out there. The time it takes to build an image with some of the tools like Aminator is like 5 minutes with a full image snapshotting. So this uses EBS volumes in Amazon world. And so an EBS snapshot does snapshotting with like a block delta. So it can be pretty fast. So if you start with a base image that is pretty much the OS and all the tools you normally use, and you drop in a 50 meg app and snapshot it, and the snapshot will be about 50 megs, and round it up to block size. So it isn't a huge amount of I/O going on in your snapshot. It's not like you're snapshotting all of 10 gigabyte image every time, completely. And it's a different philosophy, right, of how to manage things, but it means that you know when you've got a cluster of machines running, you can identify what the launch config is, you can identify what machine image when it is running on that, all the machines in that cluster, they're always identical, there are no snowflakes anywhere in there, and you can trace back, well, that's from this build, that came from this source code, that has this version of the OS and these patches, you can identify everything, you know they're always going to be the same. If somebody needs to go back and say, oh, we need to rerun a new cluster of the thing we built last week, it's right, that whole thing comes right up.
And for building the image, you have some kind of script where you say, that's what I want to have?
Yeah, so that's the Aminator tool. It's a Python script, a command line tool.
Okay.
That typically what we'll do is set it up as a Jenkins command line tool, and you just make sure the slave or the node or even whatever kind of automation you have, it has to run on an EC2 machine, but not any particular requirements, it just has to be there. So what we'll do is do an EBS volume mount on the machine, and then just a cheroot.
Okay.
And basically it does it, so one of the typical ways of creating an image is to launch something, do whatever kind of install you want, snapshot it, and then shut it down. But the launching of the machine takes quite a while. It can take another 5 to 10 minutes. So this skips that whole step by just mounting the volume without ever booting the OS on it, and then cherooting into it and mucking around in there, and then snapshot it. So it saves a whole boot. And there's also some things it saves because when you launch the machine, it actually changes things, right? So the OS is booting and services are running. Now, a snapshot, you have to shut stuff down and quit everything correctly. But so with the cheroot trick, you don't have to worry about that as much. There's still some funny little things, and Aminator takes care of that with service starting and not starting in the state exactly and getting the volumes just right before the snapshot. But, and this is extensible, so the version that Netflix put out, they use RPMs for the packages. So to deliver a bundle of stuff to put onto the OS is just an RPM, which could then have more RPMs as part of its dependency set, but that's sort of their packaging unit. At Riot, we added, and we're integrating back in, pull requests for them, Chef Solo support.
Do you have to upload the RPM anywhere, or can you use it locally?
As long as this guy can see it.
Okay.
You can push it onto the machine, or you can have a repo that is visible to him. Yeah, so so it would be nice to have more people working in this world. And there's a lot of little rough edges that have to be polished out. Like how you exactly want to do it, like where your repo is, and how you want to push the bits to the machine or to the repo. You'll have to figure that all out. How does that fit into your CI pipeline? The ones that's working in. It's just like seeing how much headache CI removes. That everybody knows the build of their war. It's always consistent because you just have Jenkins building stuff all the time. You don't worry about reproducing stuff. Like people aren't building production code on their laptops anymore, right? So this is like one step more of that. Like how did the ops guys get the bits on the machine? And how do you make sure you can do that the same every time? This is basically the scripts automates all of it. And auto-scaling the cage, I can't really make it create anything right now, but when you create an auto-scaling group in Asgard, you're really telling it how many machines do you want, because how big is it going to be, it's the most useful bit, and what kind of machine are you going to put it on, small, medium, large, all the different sizes of things, and then the image itself would be a big drop-down list here. And typically, this would be your app. So you would have baked your app, and then you would have your app here in the version, and you can type in and search and find the ones you want. And that's mostly all you fill in. Everything else can kind of be defaulted.
But if you're saying that you're just creating new machines and defaulting a new version of the app to new machines,
yeah.
How does the paying work? Because if you're having two machines running at the same time, you have to pay for both versions.
Yes. Paying for it. Yeah, you would be. So there'd be overlap, and Amazon would be charging you by the hour. So for one period of time, for one hourly billing period, at least, you're going to have done.
Okay, but it's a very small time.
Yeah, so depending on your machine, often less. So like typical would be like M1 Medium for it. It's a nice machine to run Java stuff on. $100 a month. 40 cents an hour, something like that, or less. It's definitely, if you're just running a few handful of machines at a time for a very small company, you have to be more aware of what's going on under the covers here and figure out how to. And if you want, you can shut the old one off before you build a new one, if you want to do that. So, Asgard has a notion of a cluster, which is just a tuple of auto-scaling groups that go together. And what it wants to do, sort of guide you through, is creating the auto-scaling groups for your cluster in a sequence. So maybe one, version two, version three, version four. So you're just kind of rolling forward through the sequence of numbered auto-scaling groups. So just in time, each new version of your app you push out, you just get a new auto-scaling group. So it lets you manage then at any given time two or three at once. So you can say the old one and the new one. So you can also then use the tools here to turn off traffic. So either using ELB or using another tool that service that Netflix has in the open source to manage traffic to the old ones or the new ones. So you can turn off old traffic or turn on new traffic and push stuff around that way. And maybe at some point you can try to get on with the keys and everything. Other things here. All these UIs are going to be an empty list, but there's something there. Yeah, if you do want to do auto scaling, it has all the UI for that. So you set policies and metrics to measure performance, so you can basically scale and load and more CPU and things like that. So we have none. So those are the main things that represent the model that it's managing for you. It also has UI that you manage simple DB domains, SNS topic, SQS services. So these are some of the things that people at Netflix are using. RDS database, so MySQL.
What this SQS?
The simple queuing service.
Okay.
That's message queuing. None of those are needed by Asgard, but different teams use them, so they put the UI in there. So this gives you kind of current pages to look at stuff and manage the different topics and groups. And then you can, it also lets you play around with different regions. So I have this one booting. I'm running it from IntelliJ, so I have it set to like quickly load just one region, but you can talk to all of the Amazon regions and switch around.
And the Netflix tools are running on Java?
Yeah, they're generally Java oriented, all of their productions. So the Emanator, Emanator is
Java. Well,
yeah. Asgard is Grails. So, yeah. Usually they'll tell you on the page. Tool, that's just as a tool. Python, language Python.
Yeah.
Caius, Java, Asgard, Ruby, Grails. A lot of libraries are just Java, Google, Python. So the DevOps guys and Netflix use Python. And the developers, the development stuff, yeah, Google. What is that? Chatbot. I think they use that to do some of their tracking communications on there. Curator job. So yeah, a lot of the libraries, like production libraries, are Java based.
What does the Zookeeper do?
The Zookeeper is basic. It's an open source Apache open source project that is
coordination.
Yeah. So it's sort of lock, distributed lock management. Mm-hmm. So you manage a cluster of machines, and then so Curator is a client side framework that lets you talk to Zookeeper with recipes. If you wanted to do a certain kind of use case, you'd find the right recipe in Curator and always use that. And it makes it much more declarative and easier to do stuff with that. The Zookeeper is pretty low level with my name behind. You can easily make mistakes. So Curator helps you organize that. Other tools like Ed is interesting. It was in Scala. It's a service that just watches what's going on in your cloud account. So it just scans all the time, like every 30 seconds, and looks at the objects that are there, and looks at the changes in the objects. It's going to record history of what happened.
And have some ROS and stuff.
Yeah. It has no UI at all. It's just REST. It scans, and then you have a REST API to it. So like at Riot, we have one guy who's using it to track object changes, and he's using it to scan for security issues. Like, do we have ELBs with ports that are open? So he's looking for certain rules, and he's just writing scripts on top of that. Or the monkeys can use that to look for things. So that's another one that's interesting, is the Simian Army. So this is a whole suite of machine. A whole suite of monkeys. So Chaos Monkey was the most famous one, and there's the Janitor Monkey, which I think is the most useful one for most people. And then there's a Conformity Monkey. But the
Monkey.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you know, like the monkey. So the Simian Army itself is a Java app, and the monkeys plug into it, and so they run like on a periodic basis and perform some kind of automated monkey business, right?
Oh, okay.
So Chaos Monkey will run around and just like destroy stuff. If you want that, so that it kind of ensures that your application should be resilient to failure, because machines can die. So you let the Chaos Monkey run to make sure that you're active. So if you're auto-scaling and you've got 100 machines and the monkey kills one, then it's fine. It'll just restart it and it will be okay. But if your app is stateful and you're not managing things right, you'll see problems that way. So you can run Chaos Monkey and test before you're ready to eventually run it in production.
So this search is for failure, but it doesn't rerun the task in another node, for example, in the case of the cluster.
Right. He
it
doesn't.
Scans for failures.
Well, he just creates failures.
Oh.
Chaos Monkey.
Ah,
creating failures.
Okay.
So the clusters would automatically restart nodes because the auto-scaling groups would do that. Mm-hmm. So Amazon would do that for you. So like right out of the box, the most useful monkey is probably the janitor monkey, which just scans all the objects that you have in Amazon and looks for things that are old and that may not be needed anymore. So especially things like auto-scaling groups, or sorry, not auto-scaling, like machine images that you created that are old and not being used. You can get a lot of those. You can also end up with a lot of launch configurations, which are like temporary little objects used by auto-scaling groups. EBS snapshots and volumes can sometimes get out of hand. People snapshot things. They're used during baking or image creation. Sometimes they get left over, lost, or sort of just abandoned. I think somebody might back up a database volume and forget about it. So the janitor monkey will scan. It can give you a report every day of what looks like garbage. And then also you can set a policy so it will delete things if nobody claims them after a certain period of time. So you know, snapshots that are more than 30 days old, nobody's claimed them, then we'll complete. That can help. At least you can look at a page full of listings of stuff and say, okay, these are things that could be garbage. What can we get through and delete?
Do you know anything about the chat on public tools? So I've heard of them, but I don't know what they are doing.
So they both kind of fill the same role, chef and puppet, just kind of a fork of the same idea. And what they're for, probably the best way to think about it is chef and puppet can be used to automate the building of a machine. So you can have a recipe in the chef world, they call them recipes, in a cookbook full of recipes, and you can say, I want this machine to have all these bits on it. Mm-hmm. And it's responsible for getting all the bits to the machine. Onto the machine, so it knows how to talk to repositories, so it can talk to RPM and different kind of young repositories, get the bits all onto the machine, and execute the recipes, executing how to update the current state of the machine to match the new state that you will describe. So you can say, I want you to make sure you can update Apache from this version to that version, and update Java from this version to that version. So you just describe the new state that you want, and it will figure out how to go from the old state to the new state, which is a pretty complicated problem for it to deal with. It has to deal with, oh, Apache's running, that means I have to shut it down and stop the service, and then I have to do the patches and the updates, and I have to start the service correctly and bring it all back up. So it knows how to manage the bringing up all the state changes for all the different kinds of apps. So it can do, getting the bits on the machine, configuring the machine according to a particular description of what that machine should look like in your cluster. So this, what role does that machine play, and what configuration specifically should it have, compared to other machines? And then it also helps the machines find each other, so that the chef server knows who's all out there. So every chef node, every node in your cluster, all your clusters can have a daemon running on there, which is sort of the chef client. It would register with the server, say, hey, I'm here, this is what I'm doing. Be able to communicate to negotiate what recipes it should be enforcing. But then the server also knows about what it does and where it lives on the network, its IP address and everything. So then they can communicate to everybody else to describe, you need to talk to him, he needs to talk to him. That's how they can find each other.
So this is probably when you're creating your own cluster in cloud and not using Amazon services.
Right. Yeah, yes. It's a philosophical difference. A lot of people use Amazon use Chef too, which I don't think is the right tool for it. It's a very difficult problem that they're trying to solve with one tool. And the approach that we took at Netflix and that I'm basically trying to sell at Riot is that's really three different jobs, so we'll use three different tools for that. And so one of them is we use Aminator, which you can use Chef Solo as the package installed. So that part will take care of getting all the bits onto the machine. And then we snapshot that and you're done. And that reproducing that exact perfect, tested, pristine copy of the machine now is really easy because you've got a snapshot. The other bits of how do you get configuration to the machine, or tell each, like this cluster should work with certain settings and this cluster should work with some other settings. There is other tools in the Amazon world.
Have you show maybe Vagrant, Have you used Vagrant?
I have.
Yeah.
Vagrant is very cool. I'm trying to figure out how.
Kind of wrapper on.
Yeah, so Packer can be used to make Vagrant images. So
I think you could.
Yeah, so it's one of the things they can do. He does it as a like a post package step. So you can create an AMI and a Vagrant image of your machine and then run it. But with Vagrant is a way of command line tool to manage a virtual box.
With Vagrant, you have your own local machine and you do all the stuff that you need, but if you use the same configuration to push it up on Amazon,
yeah.
So you can just test stuff at Amazon and then set it up with your local machine.
What is the name of the actual main project for Vagrant?
Vagrant.com.
So with Vagrant, you can use machine images of different types, so like VMware images and Amazon images, so you can test things locally that way. Packer can make Amazon and VMware images and Vagrant at the same time. There's another tool that's interesting, which I've only read about and tinkered with, called Docker, which is promising if you just want something to explore. This is it's a way of managing a lightweight container, so LXC containers on Linux. And so you can create a very tiny container of just your app and launch it then under, in contact with Vagrant. So you can run it under a Vagrant image, you can run it on your machine. You can run it on, on Amazon, you can run it anywhere. It's sort of a sub-container within the virtual machine. So it's not virtualizing at all, it's just using Linux LXC lightweight containers. But the container format is pretty important, so that's why it's really interesting, is that same exact container, bit for bit, can be run in all these different environments. So somehow that seems to be promising that you could.
That's a Java developer, it seems compelling, right?
Yeah.
The same container.
If you could automate the construction of a Docker container, this is part of a normal IDE build and just run stuff and set up your IntelliJ to talk to stuff running on these things. You can have multiple machines, like an entire little cluster running on your laptop of all the machines in your microservices that you're trying to test.
Has anybody taken a look at Cloud Live Rebel? So Live Rebel is a tool from that does JRebel.
Yeah.
So. On those machines to actually push out your applications and stuff like that.
Yeah, now it's kind of a different approach, very much from the Java side of things. Yeah, this is kind of like a look at the whole OS. So this is completely agnostic to Java or Python, whatever language you want to run on the machine. It's just like any kind of OS level of thing.
And how major are these tools? Are they creating more problems than they're helping with? Or?
So like Docker and Packer are really new and not even production. So like, but there's something to look at, like this is like version 0.3. Yeah. So, I mean, they're building images that are running on environments that are very mature. So if it makes the image that works, then you're okay. Emanator is what Netflix uses for production. So it's mature. It's a rewrite of what they had initially. So this implementation is only a few months old, but the philosophy and how they build things is 2 or 3 years old. It's how they're running thousands of machines, building mold, basically building apps and deploying many apps a day using these tools. And AsGuard2 is only 4 years old.
So this is very much configuration of machines and setup of OS, hardware, databases, app servers, whatever.
Yeah.
But could you can say no, of course, this is your session, but could you move into kind of the process of actually, what I'm supposed to do as a developer to make do the entire chain work, or I'm as a developer, but now I have an application that I need to go to kind of a workflow. It should be tested, it should be accepted, and then suddenly it's supposed to be out in production, and I want to automate the entire process. And we've done this with kind of with both Amazon and Vagrant, and we've done, we've pretty much had Jenkins as the orchestrator to make it work. And I'm disappointed. We had some serious issues with that, you know. There seems to be missing pieces to make it work.
Jenkins is a good at just following kind of linear steps. Right?
Yes.
It isn't very smart and not very interactive, but it could be used as a building block. Right?
But the first thing that happens is that you have the build process up and everything works, and then somebody is supposed to accept it, and that kicks up another build, and you know, whatever you do, any change kicks up another build, and then you need to write ugly code to skip certain types of check-ins and stuff like that. And I'm not sure that's right, but that actually is that you're supposed to be orchestrating everything.
So one thing, if you do the whole model where you make a machine image, is that it makes a nice splitting point. So you let Jenkins build the machine, and then it's kind of done. And it can just do continuous builds of your machines. And then what your exceptions testing is the machine image. And so then you can do that with tools that are later down the chain, right? So then you have to go back in and rebuild anything ever again. You've got kind of this clean separation. Produce the bits, and then you test them in whatever kind of process you want there. And then when you're happy with them, you have that artifact. So that build artifact is the same thing that's being tracked. You say, okay, that's the build we want to put to production. And you can just go launch it in Escrow. But Netflix is playing around with tools to do that. Others, like multiple teams there, were writing their own tooling around that. So it's a complex problem because you don't really know what how people want to work. So really, how you want to do that workflow testing and sign off, and it really depends on the team, the company, and at Netflix, all the teams are different at that level. They're using the same low-level tools for any job, the sharing code, and at the end, it's how the QA team and the release engineers and the developers and the ops, and they're all different. It's all very so freedom and responsibility there, and that's the layer at the very top where they're all very different. So it was hard to dictate. Here's your process flow, and they just have to get it right out of it.
I think I'm looking at kind of a mix of the two that actually is a kind of a workflow, graphic workflow tool.
Yeah.
So you can see here's all my setup, an abstraction of all my machines and all my environments. I can see what applications are installed in what version, and if they are, in what state they are. So, and meaning that if you're in the acceptance test environment, I should go into that graphical tool, I open that, and I sign it off, and when I've done that, it's queued up for next night, whatever, and then it kicks off to build a new machine, put on the latest package on there, and then...
But the machine should already be built, right? Because you're acceptance testing the machine that was already built. The only thing you need to do when you say you sign off is you push one button that says okay, then it goes production live instantly, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's it. And eventually that could be a monkey that just says you passed all the tests. But you can have a human in there just to verify all those tests, right? So you can have...
But you're mixing people because you're doing this with Amazon, right?
Yeah.
So you're using auto-scaling.
Yeah.
In my customer, they have, the production machines are 10 times faster and more memory than the testing environment. So
how good can your testing be then?
Okay. Do I need to answer that? I just crawl under here. That's a very good question. We asked that as well.
We
cannot do performance testing.
Where is your CI pipeline sitting in the cloud as well? Jenkins, does that run in AWS?
I think at Netflix, still not sure where they are now since I've left. They're in the process of moving all of it to Amazon. The slaves all ran on Amazon. So the build slide. And master was stuck in the data center at the time just because that's where it started. And they wanted to do some cleanup before they moved it, that was all. But yeah, at Riot, I'm using it's got a Jenkins set up just for baking at this point in time. In the master, I'm doing the builds on the master. I just have one master that does what it needs to do. And it's right on EC2. I like to use US West 1 for tools. It's convenient because I'm in California. And it's a smaller region, so it's not really very suited for production. Because it only has two availability zones. So if you really want to run production, you want some redundancy, you want at least three availability zones. And you want to spread out your clusters that way. So the other regions are better. But it's less important now because you can play around with VPC and segregate your tools from your production. The Netflix model separates your world into two halves. You have sort of production, and they have a separate account for production. So you know that you're not accidentally pushing things into production. And then everything else. So your tools and your dev and your test and integration tests, everything that's not production is all in one big account. And everyone can see each other and all your tools work. And how you want to divide integration test from dev and smoke test, whatever, that's all the stuff to the teams. And it's just more of a formality around how you group your clusters.
How good is the documentation to get started?
I think it's good. So it's fine. Asgard was here. This wiki page there is a Google group that's pretty active. So the wiki's pretty good. Quick starting guide. There's definitely concepts in there that you might have trouble with. It assumes you know Amazon. So you have to go
because I've had a quick look at that chef, I think, and it was very, I didn't know where to start. I was just looking at the presentation. Ooh, I don't understand anything.
Yeah, I mean, the chef, it throws you into the deep end.
Yeah.
You either sink or swim. There are some tutorials for chef that are interesting. One of the newest interesting tools for chef is called Burp Shelf. And that's actually done by a guy from Riot. Just pushed it out there. And there's a tutorial for Burp Shelf, if you can find it.
How's that spelled?
B-E-R-K Shelf. It's a play on words. It's from this meme, internet meme, where there's a girl standing there with a bunch of books, and she says, Ermaker Boogers. But, it's on GitHub, I think. So the reason they picked a silly word like that was if you Google it, all you get. If it was called bookshelf, you Google it, you'll never find it, right? So that's why they did it. So that's the GitHub page for it. And there's the home page. This also kind of assumes, here's how you install and play with it. But it assumes you know Chef, and you know how to work with Ruby, and you know what gems are, and how to set up all the repos. But once it's done, it helps you manage your cookbooks really automatically, very easily. And somewhere there's a tutorial. Let's see.
Yeah, we have 2 minutes left.
Yeah. The Burp Shelf way. So Jamie Windsor is the author of Burp Shelf. And so, yeah, you can start there. He has a tutorial called My Face. It's sort of sample app, Hello World, but it's a little fake, Facebook kind of app. And he walks through using that app to talk about how to use the chef tools. And workshop to deploy it and to manage it and make cookbooks and walk you through all of it. So this is Jamie. And there's your experience with Chef. Looks like that, right? The learning curve.
Nice.
Yeah.
So what do you feel that is the real problem with the Chef on Puppet then?
I don't know. I didn't have a... I just really was getting through the documentation I don't know, 15 minutes. I didn't understand anything, but I didn't have more time, so
I think if you know, I'm not that used to Ruby and UBDSL, and that makes it a bit harder, I guess, to figure everything out.
There's another equivalent, I can't remember the name of it, that's for Python. It's been around for a while, and maybe it's gaining some popularity again.
Jenkins on a Mac Mini on an ADSL line rather than Jenkins on a